Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. The room is kind of full, so if you can't hear me, I encourage you to do something like this. Because I'll do my best, but it's hard to know what you're perceiving. In fact, impossible. Anyway, glad to be with you here today. Kind of a precious time, just a few days where the leaves are doing whatever it is they're doing, which is so beautiful. Maybe you're despairing because it's getting cold. So if that's true, I send you love. I'm going to give a talk today called Trauma, Karma, and Healing. Trauma, Karma, and Healing. Well, the first thing I want to say is, I am not a therapist, and I have no particular training in providing trauma therapy, so the information I'll provide about trauma is as a lay person, also a person who's received extensive treatment for post-traumatic stress, and talked to people a lot about trauma and read some books. So if you believe that you are experiencing lasting effects from trauma, or if you think you may have been traumatized, I encourage you to find a therapist. And if you don't find one you think is helping, find another one until you find one who you think is helping. And if you feel like you're having intrusive memories about traumatic events, you feel like you're spending a lot of energy suppressing intrusive memories about traumatic events, if you are having pervasive feelings of hopelessness or anxiety, or outbursts of intense anger, shame, or fear, if you're struggling with addiction, if you're having trouble with the relationships in your life, I encourage you to find a therapist. And if that therapist doesn't seem to be helping, to find another therapist until you find one who you think is helping. And this is a message that you'll get if you come for a practice meeting with the teacher. I hope people aren't taken aback, because we frequently say, are you in therapy? Because people suffer. Because I'm here because I'm interested in people being well. And Western therapeutic models are effective. They're not perfect, but they're effective. And you might think, well, wait, I came to talk about Zen and now you're talking about therapy. Well, here's the thing. You can practice Zen and you can eat. Is that Zen practice? It is if you do it as Zen practice. You can go for a walk and you can do it as Zen practice. You can run, you can go to the gym, you can go to the doctor, you can take medicine, you can go to therapy, you can go to political action events. Nothing is excluded from the realm of what can be done with the aspiration that everyone be free from suffering, which is the central idea that Zen emerges from. And then we can do whatever we're doing with some skillfulness. So yeah, you can go to therapy and speak true, kind, and timely. And you can be aware of the body, and you can be aware of how you feel. Mindfulness. You can experience deep states of concentration. The path is available. Trauma is, it's a term that is very prevalent in contemporary discourse. I think if you did like a Google usage search on the word trauma, it would just be like, whew. So that's part of the reason I'm talking about this. People bring it up. Trauma used to generally be thought of as like a specific, intensely disturbing event. But over time, because of people studying how trauma works in people's lives, it is generally being defined less as being about the event and more about the lasting impacts of the event. So on the bulletin, I included this quotation from Bessel van der Kolk, who's a very prominent doctor who studies trauma and has written a book that is very influential called The Body Keeps the Score. He says, we have learned that trauma is not just an event that took place sometime in the past. It is also the imprint left by that experience on mind, brain, and body. So, you know, we can pause to acknowledge that in Israel, in Gaza right now, there is enormous, massive scale trauma occurring. So people are being killed, people are being held hostage, people's homes are being destroyed, people are being displaced. It's, you know, horrendous, horrendous. And, you know, from one lens, you could say these horrible things are happening, which is true. And I think people don't like it, but I'd like to point out that we are paying for civilians to be killed because we pay taxes and our money goes to send munitions to Israel, which are killing civilians in Gaza. So it's worth acknowledging that the impact of the trauma is something we can't be separate from. This is a basic principle of Mahayana Buddhism. And it's painful to acknowledge, but I don't think we're going to get out of the messes we're in if we can't acknowledge what is true. So having said that, it's also true that from the lens of the contemporary view of trauma, when you look at what's happening in this particular crisis in Israel and Gaza, you can see that it's connected to many, many years of trauma, to the displacement of the Palestinian people, to the Holocaust, to thousands of years of anti-Semitism. And many other harmful things, racism, anti-Islamic bias, hatred. So it's all there. It's part of a system that produces suffering. So this is the lens through which trauma is being viewed now. So if you're ever like, someone just said, like they referred to something as trauma that didn't seem like trauma to me. They're coming from this perspective of seeing that systems where harm occurs are systems, and they have systemic impacts, and they manifest in a personal life, and they manifest in that holistic space as well. So karma, I'm going to use definitions of karma that come from the Buddhist textual tradition, particularly the earliest texts on karma from the Pali Canon and from the Yogacara tradition. So the basic idea is, we could say, every action plants a seed that will create a similar action. Action is a translation of the word karma. And by action here, we mean things that you do with the body, which includes speech, things that you do with the mind, which includes interpreting speech, but a lot of other things, emotions. In the simplest terms, Buddha says, in a very definitional case, he says, karma is intention. And the thing is, this is confusing because people think intention might mean like just your kind of ideas about what you should be doing, but that's not what this means. Karma is intention refers to the fact, intention means those things which produce what you do. Those things that produce what you do, the vast majority of which we don't know what they are. Really, like, think about it. How is it that you're listening to me and understand what I'm saying? How does that even happen? A lot of agreements are occurring right now, so you guys aren't all just like looking out the window or wandering around or like looking at the floor. Like, if we were babies without a lot of karmic conditioning, you will look really different in here. So we have enormous amounts of conditioning that produce every single moment. And we're just like, well, of course it's like this. It's not an of course. It's conditioning that we created individually and that collectively we created. So we have cultures that create coming together. We have personal tendencies. We have familial tendencies. Every little moment of hearing a word produces the ability to make meaning from that word. Every little motion, moment of emotion produces a similar emotion. Now, the basic So it's not an innovation, but the orientation of thinking about karma in Buddhism, which is thought about in many ways, is that the point of using karma as a system in Buddhism is to remind us that we have power. Because right now we are contributing to what will be experienced. We are planting seeds for what the world we're going to live in. Wow! So every action plants a seed that will bear fruit. So when you have a difficult emotion, if you can bring compassionate attention to that emotion, you've planted seeds of compassion. That matters. That matters. What if every time someone experienced a difficult emotion, the response that came up was compassion? This world would look extremely different than it does, I think. So having said this, there are a lot of teachings there's a substantial body of texts in the Majjhima Nikaya of the Pali Canon and in other places in Buddhism, and it's very common in Buddhism to think of karma in very mechanical terms, which I'm just going to say I respect many views, but I don't think they're helpful. So there's a large body of texts that say basically things like, if you steal in this life, you will probably be reborn at some point without one of your hands. Or if you, if you're really greedy in this life and hoard wealth, you'll be born as a pauper. Or born in the hungry ghost realm, where it is a lot worse than being a pauper. So these kind of views are very common. So I've heard them expressed by a lot of people. There's canonical textual support for them, so it's part of Buddhism. I acknowledge that completely, and I don't think they're helpful. I don't use them, and I don't encourage you to use them. So I'm going to just fly over that and just say, all right, well, we're going to have a big debate later. And some of my colleagues who think they're useful, I just bow. We can have different views. So I don't know if you can hear as I'm talking about these two things, the commonality between the idea that an impact of an extremely traumatic event is going to have effects downstream. And here, notice that the trend in thinking about karma is the impact that matters more than the event. This is very specifically what the Buddha is saying. He says your well-being is not conditioned inherently, but the way you experience an event is what plants those seeds for what will come. So that's to say, like, if someone is like angry and yelling and you're like, oh, that person seems really upset and there's a lot of suffering there, that plants a certain kind of seed. And if you're like, that person is just a that plants a different kind of seed. Just for a simple example. So I would say one of the biggest differences, though, so I'm making this kind of commonality between contemporary karma theories about karma trauma and traditional accounts of karma in Buddhism. But a big difference is, and this is consistent in across almost every category of mental illness or difficulty you can have, is that in Buddhism you don't get a separate category. So it's not like trauma is over here as a separate category. It's like everybody, no matter what, is planting seeds for what will happen. And if, for example, you have a horribly traumatic event and your consciousness just tries to suppress the feeling as well it can, it alienates itself from the body and it has all this anguish that it can't look at and somehow it's hiding, then all that hiding and those terrible feelings and that dissociation will be built into how you are. But it's also true that if you're walking down the street and you're not really paying attention to your body and you're just up in your thoughts and thinking about how you can get a new iPhone, you're planting seeds for being alienated from your body and thinking about how to get an iPhone. Right? So there's not a separate category. And this is true like for addiction too. It's like basically in Buddhism we're all addicts. We're addicted to greed, hate, and delusion. And everybody without exception has the ability to do something that helps us get free, both individually and collectively. So I wrote a book I wrote a few books, but I'm going to read a little bit from this book I wrote called Vasubandhu's Three Natures. I'm going to read from several passages from this, which this chapter is called Trauma, Perception, and Healing. When I first came to Zen practice, I was also undertaking several years of therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. I began to shed old fixed views and obsessions. I began to heal. I began to believe that the rage, the terror, the despair, and the overpowering shame I experienced were not happening because I was a bad person. I began to believe that they were not necessary components of myself or necessary fuel for my work as a musician. I began to let go of the idea that the harm I had experienced was my fault or insignificant. I began to see that all the harm I had created was my responsibility, but not my destiny. I discovered that I was not clearly seeing the things and the people I feared and at whom I raged. The process of this awakening was wondrous and often very painful. At the very root of it was the understanding shared by my Buddhist teachers and therapists that my feelings, thoughts, and view of the world were arising due to a collection of past and present conditions. I suffered and caused so much harm because of habits of thought, emotion, and embodiment, but they were merely habits, and habits can change. So, this is personal to me. So, just for full disclosure's sake. So, anyway, current ideas that we have about trauma, you know, there are some sources I just want to mention. As I understand it, in some of Freud's early work, was he was kind of forming what became psychology. He was treating women who are defined at that time as hysterics. And he was like, oh, the problem is mostly these people are experiencing endemic sexual abuse, violence, sexual abuse and violence. And as he started to talk about this, people are like, that is an unacceptable view and disgusting. And he was like, oh, I'm never going to get anywhere talking about this. So he completely changed his model of how to explain the problem. So how did that happen? He was just listening to people talk about their experience. So we saw a big resurgence in thinking about trauma, I think, in Western thought from the lens that I'm talking about now. Because there was a lot of research done on Vietnam veterans, from American veterans from the American War in Vietnam. And this was probably in large part because the military has a lot of money. They have a lot of money to research stuff. And they're like, wow, this is impeding our ability to execute war, is that people are being completely debilitated from the impacts of the war. So there's a lot of research done, and that sort of started to spawn a much larger and broader body of research. And in all these cases, you can see that there's a combination of the direct personal experience who's had, you know, an extreme distressing experience and that produced a lot of emotions that tend to reproduce themselves. But you can also see that it's systemic, because the condition of endemic sexual violence against women is well established to be true now, although it was denied at the time of Freud's work. And, you know, you can see with a war, the impacts of trauma are both systemic, they're created by a system, but they also occur exclusively, in a certain sense, within a person's own experience. So the personal and the systemic are alive here, just as they are in our Buddhist teachings. We start to also see, as people think about trauma, a realization that you don't have to have a single extreme event to create trauma responses. So it's not usually, the language of trauma is not that often used, I think, in the cases of talking about what are called ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. But ACEs is kind of a, basically people looked at public health and they were like, wow, when kids have these particular kinds of negative experiences, they have a similar set of negative outcomes. So ACEs are things like having food insecurity in the home, having addicts who you live with, having people with extreme mental illness who are raising you, extreme poverty. I can't remember all the ACEs, but there it's like this little rubric. And basically you can just ask people a survey, how many of the ACEs do you have? And then you can measurably see that people who have a lot of ACEs are more likely to be incarcerated, to have addiction, to have problems with maintaining employment and a lot of other conditions. So here you don't have necessarily have to have an extreme negative event. You can just have a context that's bad for you, like poverty, right? This talk is heavier than I had planned. So I love you all from the bottom of my heart, and I'm glad you're here with me. So I have enormous faith that if we face what is true, that is the path of liberation. So, anyway, this kind of broader views of trauma expanding, I'm going to read another little passage from this text. So, as some of you may or may not know, time in Mahayana thought isn't real. But another way to think of it is our particular views of time are always limited. And many, many ways of viewing time have utility. So in this book, I'm talking about the Yogacara view of time, but I'm going to read a little passage here. The growing cultural awareness of the impact of trauma is starting to soften conventional views on sharp divisions of time and identity. It is well documented that shame and corporal punishment will change a child's behavior in the short term. It can make them sit down and shut up. It is also well documented that children who are disciplined with shame and corporal punishment are much more likely to experience poverty, addiction, behavioral problems, and incarceration. It appears that the phenomenon of a cowed child told to sit down and shut up arose at one time, while the phenomenon of an officer pushing someone into the back of a police car arose at another. But these are in fact interdependent. The illusion of momentary control is always dependent on ignoring vast, unknowable impacts. This is why I invite you to give up trying to control anything ever for any reason. And I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. You can make an offering of your effort without trying to control something. It's possible. What are we doing when we sit zazen? That's the whole practice. So I found, like, I was just like looking at things about trauma recovery tools, and I was like, this is very consistent with basic elements of Buddhist practice. So, you know, I like looked at this list. It's like, you got to acknowledge the cause of the suffering and have a look at how it occurs. So they call it psychoeducation. Visualization and relaxation methods that allow us to develop stability. So people who have intense trauma reactions, it's like suddenly you're just completely overwhelmed with god-awful emotions. It's hard. Or maybe really suppressed and dissociated from your experience. So finding ways to be able to just get stable and safe. So I've told this story many times, but when I came here, you know, I was not in a stable position, but I was really into Zen, and I came into Tim and I said, I'm just trying to be with my body and my emotions all day, and it's so intense. I think I'm getting free, but it's overwhelming. And he said, have you tried watching TV? Really, finding some wisdom and trust in what we actually need right now, it's not one thing. So that finding ways to become stable and have a sense of safety. Mindfulness of the body. So many trauma therapists talk about one of the fundamental problems of trauma is alienation from the body. Well, that's the fundamental problem that Buddhism presents us with. To start to get into the body is a way to get to the emotions and then open up to the world in a new way. So trauma therapies will often be about learning to ground yourself in the body in a way that's bearable, because sometimes people with trauma, it's a terrifying, terrifying experience. So you gotta, we call it titrate it, which means like measure the dose. And the same is true of dealing with your emotions. And you might be like, well, I don't feel traumatized, but this sounds like a good idea. Yes, that's because it's basic Buddhist practice to learn how to tolerate your own embodied experience, your own emotions. They talk about creating a positive and beneficial view of self and surroundings. Yeah, that is a basic element to Buddhist practice. You got Buddha nature and you're in the Dharmakaya. Can't get more positive and beneficial than that. What we really don't see very much, I could pull some threads out, but it would be very detailed work. That a lot of trauma therapies involve learning how to face the traumatic memory, you know, like in a, what they call a titrated way so that you can bear it. And there's very little of that in the Buddhist teaching. So that's one of the reasons why trauma therapy isn't particular indicated. If you're going, wow, you're talking about me, well, my heart goes to you and I'm talking about me, and we can get help. So, the Buddha met some traumatized people, actually lots of them. Two occasions where he meets traumatized people, I just want to mention his encounter with Patachara, who is a woman who, in the story we have, experienced a series of extremely traumatic events, one after the other. And you, when you tell the story, it's like, it's intense, I'm not going there. But then she becomes so overwhelmed by all this that she is just like living on the outskirts of town, eating garbage and wandering around naked. And her hair is all matted and she's just like a complete outcast. And of course, we have a lot of people who live on the outskirts of town. They're not looking like the way we think people should look. They're suffering a lot. This is not like a Buddha time problem. There are many, many profoundly traumatized people living barely on the edge of life and on society in our community. So anyway, but this is like something here Buddhism is talking about 2,500 years ago, Patachara. And on the other side of the corner, you have Angulimala, who's the mass murderer, whose name means finger necklace. And he's going around, he's got a necklace made of the fingers of peoples he murdered. So in both cases, what does the Buddha do when he gets, well, with Patachara, he encounters her just by chance, this is a naked woman. And all the monks are like, oh my God, you know, we can't even look at women who have clothes on. And he walks right up to her. He walks right up to her. And when he goes to the town where Angulimala is terrorizing people, they go, there's this mass murderer, you gotta get out of here. He goes straight to where Angulimala is. Because there is nothing more consistent in the story of the Buddha's life in his utter confidence that every person, no matter what, has the capacity to do something conducive to liberation right now. Right now. The stories may seem a little miraculous because he meets them and pretty much immediately they're like, great, I'm going to ordain and become a monastic. So, I don't know. Maybe one of you will train here and become a really good teacher and be really inspiring. But in both cases, the story we see is he goes, he meets the person who's at the very outside edge of trauma, because killing people is traumatic. Give me a break. So he goes to these people and he meets them with this confidence and they enter the path and there's this sudden awakening, right? Bodhicitta, the awakening of the aspiration and a commitment. And then in the stories of both of them, it's flipping hard. It's hard. And we'll go into the details, but they struggle. But they stay with the commitment. But this tradition doesn't say, oh, magically, it's just all gone. This is another commonality with how people think about karma who study trauma. It's not like, I dug D healed. You know, it's practice, and it can be hard. So I have a really long reading here. I'm just not going to do. That's how it's going to be. Because I want to talk about this. This is pretty important. So in both cases, there's trust. So the Buddha meets the person with trust and confidence in their ability. And then they have a trusting relationship. And this is a tricky thing because for many people, traumatized or not, on the Buddhist path, but also with trauma, trusting yourself can be hard. Trusting yourself can be hard. And we get these tools for building up trust in ourselves, both in the case of thinking about trauma and karma, which are kind of confusing. Because in the case of trauma, what you want to realize, one of the things you want to know is, I'm not seeing what is real when I'm in a trauma response. So like if someone's been in a combat zone and they hear a helicopter and they get under the table at dinner, it's going to be helpful to be like, that is not actually a combat helicopter and no one is going to blow up my house. That is a useful part of the process. Now, acknowledging that the feeling you're experiencing is really matters and needs to be taken care of is important too. So this sounds pretty extreme, but here again is where Buddhism doesn't make a, like, we're talking about these people over here, because the basic idea is all of us are wrong about what's happening all the time. Really? That's what the teaching of emptiness says. All the ideas we have about things are not absolute truths. And we act like they are, and it causes us to suffer a lot. And that's kind of freaky. So how do you come in here and chant the Heart Sutra about how everything you think is true isn't true, and then say, yes, trust yourself? Well, I would say that is very, you're like, that sounds pretty Zen, because, you know, it's very opposite. It's maybe more subtle in the context of someone learning to understand that when they're in a trauma response, they're not probably seeing things clearly at all, but they also can't trust themselves. But there's a deep commonality in being able to acknowledge that my particular view isn't the absolute truth, but I can still learn to trust that I can make a choice right now that's conducive to well-being and liberation for people. So, I'm going to read a little thing out of this book here, shorter one. I first started learning about post-traumatic stress disorder when I was in high school, researching what my Vietnamese friends called the American War. The challenges U.S. veterans of the war experienced when they came home to the States were wrenching, as was the fact that I could find so little information about the impacts on the people of Vietnam. I recall reading about veterans going back home to the United States, diving to the ground or crouching under tables at the sound of fireworks or a backfiring car. They heard the sounds of impending death or mortars and gunfire. I learned that for many veterans, part of recovery was realizing that the emotions they experienced when they heard a bottle rocket must be cared for, that the gunfire they imagined was not real, and that they could create conditions so people would not have to suffer similar trauma. So simultaneously seeing that the projections we have are not absolute truths, that it's important to care for the body and the emotions, and that we can do something that makes a world that's more safe for everyone. That's possible. So there is this sense of caring for the self. Turn the light to shine within, then just return. Take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. This is the language of the founders of the Zen tradition. what's going on here? What would help? Because it's so easy to just act from conditioned reactivity, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe not for you. Your spouse says something you're not enthusiastic about. Shut down, walk away, snap back. I don't know what it is. Your kids are doing something that drives you crazy and it's just, I had a practice that I early in my recovery from trauma and in Zen practice, my son Rocky, I love you, I bow to you, did not like to get up in the morning very much. And was always, he tends to be late. So at some point I decided, instead of yelling and passing on what I have received, when it's time to go and he's not ready, I'm going to play the piano until it's time to go. And my piano playing is way better. What kind of world do I want to live in? What kind of world do I want to live in? So Buddhist practice can be traumatizing. Important to acknowledge. You know, one of the most common ways that we see is when teachers abuse their power, especially see them abuse power, sexually manipulate their students, but in other ways as well. So it's really important that we create a context, that I take responsible for creating a context where we're not doing that. But it is real. So it's good to acknowledge, because there might be people sitting here who are like, yeah, I've experienced that. But in other ways, the thing is, almost anything can be a trauma trigger. So we can't just figure it out and have a formula. So like, I know some people is like, I come here and it's silent on retreat. Thank God. I don't have to talk to people. All my social anxiety can be like, and it's quiet and I have some peace. Other people walk in here and that silence is the silence of a home filled with terror. Or they report that it's the silence of a culture where white people won't talk about racism. The silences that bind us. And so they have traumatic responses in a place that for some of us is this refuge. Looking at the walls, I was like, oh God, thanks. So simple. Yeah. Other people come to me and be like, oh, it's just like this horrible punishment I used to receive in my abusive home. Yeah, it's tough. Awareness of the body can be completely overwhelming. If you can't tolerate it, it's okay. Do something else. So I can't list all the things that could be triggering here, but we can collectively know that that's part of the deal, so we can care for each other. And if you need help, you can ask for help. If you need to change what you're doing and do something that isn't going to be overwhelming, go ahead and do it. Yeah. Yeah, there's room for all different kinds of people. And this practice doesn't have to look like something in a box. So there's a term that was developed for healthcare settings called trauma-informed care. And there's, you know, it's a big field, but there's some really nice principles. Safety, creating a place where people feel safe, where they have choice, where they have empowerment, where the people they're meeting are trustworthy, where there's collaboration. So if you know much about traditional monastic Zen culture, you might be like, I'm not sure that's a good fit. We don't really practice traditional monastic culture here, but there's a lot of like, you come in and you just follow all the rules and the teacher tells you what to do. So very good. A powerful, transformative thing, but we want to hold it with the awareness that it can be harmful to people. And so we're trying to create a context here where we can carry that forward in a way that actually helps and supports people and lets them let go of their egos and try some new things on. But we also, it's really important that I want you to know that you can choose what to do. And I hope we can create a culture together where we feel like we can trust each other and this place is safe. And you might think, well, of course it's safe, but for some people it does not feel safe. And that's what matters, how people feel, because this is Buddhism. The point of Buddhism is to alleviate suffering. So what else are we up to? But caring about how people are and caring about all of them. So, I don't know, this has been part of my life and thinking for so long, I kind of forgot how heavy it would be. You know, because for me, it's not heavy. It isn't. This has been the ground of my liberation. An enormous ability to feel in my own body and to trust my own sense of goodness and to meet people and serve people has emerged directly through looking right at this stuff. So I'm forgetful. And so if this has landed on you like a heavy weight, I'm sorry. But I hope it may be part of a process where air comes in. You see just how spacious each moment is. Just at the limits of your peripheral vision. Vastness. What are we hearing? What is that sound I'm hearing from that room? I don't need to figure it out. It just shows me how big this moment is with all of you and everyone, everywhere, throughout space and time. Thank you. So we have some time for people to bring your voices. Can be questions are welcome. Reflections are welcome too, but it's nice to have short reflections because there's over 100 people in this meeting. So I want to make room for many voices. And if you're online, you might want to use your raise your hand or use your hand raise function just because there's a lot of people. Or if you're in here, just speak.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I liked what you said about the idea of giving up all control of other people. It feels like that makes a lot of space for non-judgmentalism and encouraging their healing encouraging their healing in terms of helping them be who they are, be comfortable in who they are. But I was thinking about, on the other hand as well, because while I work at North High School, and I know there are sometimes things come in where I have to do something to control the situation, where there's behaviors happening that I have to interject myself and do some control to stop those things from happening. So I was just asking, you know, like, could you provide some clarification.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know if you all could hear that, but basically the question is, yeah, it's making space for people without trying to control them is healing, but sometimes you have to do something, you know, you have to intervene. There's harm being done. So it's a subtle thing. The thing is, I can get up and say, it's really important that you stop doing that. I can even use my body to prevent something from happening without trying to control the outcome. That's possible. So the focus is entirely on me doing the thing, which I believe to be a liberative action. So it's not objectifying. So it's attitudinal. So it's the action could look actually exactly the same from an objective perspective, but there's not a sense that there's an object outside of me that can be controlled, nor that there's a future that can be controlled. There's just, this is the call for me to act.
Thank you.
I see Dawn. Go ahead.
Ben, thank you very much. I really appreciate the validation and the language as we talk about all of these things, about trauma and recovery and connection and communication. As we talk about it more, we bring it more to our awareness and ease to do that. I'm just very grateful. Thank you so much for the talk today. It means a lot.
Thanks, Dawn. Thank you. Okay, yeah, Raymond.
There's a professor from Stanford, I can't remember his name, but his basic theory is that there is no free will.
Oh.
That everything that, you know, it's kind of like karma, but you have no free will. Everything you do is determined by something else in the past. That's his theory. Could you perhaps contrast that with karma, with planting of seeds?
Yeah, well, what I'll say, you know, people have said this about free will in various contexts. I would just say in Buddhist thought, there is no space for the elimination of free will, because the whole point and the relentless message is you have liberative capacity. And actually, in Buddhism, philosophy is never done to attain some kind of apparently objective truth, but to serve that thesis. So, because that's just what we're doing. So even if you could really prove that there's no free will, Buddhism would be like, I don't care. Really? Because what we're trying to do is help people feel their energy for liberation. And that's the point of the tradition. So I appreciate this person, and maybe he'll have some useful input for all of us, but there's some Buddhism. Go ahead.
Yeah, I saw Five Nights at Freddy's last night, and this is a lot about this, about facing the illusion of your trauma, or rather the memory of your trauma. And man, it was something. The theater, these little kids were there, and I was just like, oh my god. And they were laughing at this stuff. I saw a bunch of like NC-17 almost. But it was a wonderful movie. Because it is a lot about that, like the memory coming back and then finding yourself in patterns now of trying to go back and fix that thing that happened, change it. So it maybe really talks about the prison, you know, you put yourself in while you're not in the present moment. It's really good.
Thank you. Thank you. Five Nights at Freddy's. Good name. Haven't seen it. Go ahead.
Thank you for the talk. This was really helpful. I wonder if you could say something. One thing that I notice in lots of world events, obviously what's going on in Palestine right now is a great example of this, but coming back to when I see a lot of like activism or people talking on social media or even in real life, I get really, what really shuts me down is that I know how all of these ideas of what we think we know are just built on things that we've heard that we actually have no idea about, and where I get really shut down personally because I don't know how to act based on what that guy said, based on what that person said, what they watched on the news, you know, whatever. And just wondering if you have something helpful to say on that front.
Yeah, it is very tricky, and you know, it's good to have a lot of humility, I think. I mean, I do think the Buddhist tradition invites us to have profound humility about what we think the world is. But at the same time, to have some confidence to act. And in many cases, you know, listening is the best thing. If you want to be like active and sort of take a position, it's really good to have a very good reason to do that. Because you can just see a lot of evidence in your community. I do think a lot of times when it comes to activism, my activism is always community and relationally based. It's actually essentially about building relationships, trust, empowerment, awareness of how we feel. In the case, you know, there have been a real problem in this recent crisis in Israel and Gaza is people are just leaping in and saying horrible things based on like taking one side. And I don't think that helps. Being able to acknowledge the vast suffering of everyone involved, including yourself, because it impacts you. And then say, what is going to help? More weapons? More violence? As a Buddhist, I'm unequivocal in saying no. Thank you. Let's see. One more? Yeah.
And thanks so much for this topic, first of all. And last 7 years, any moment that is association with you, be it a book or the talks that you give, it has been always a great learning moment. Thank you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sharing all those things that you've learned. Going back to the free will, just trying to synthesize two things and admit it, settle it as a statement. Please check this into a right understanding. There is both free will, there is also karma. So karma is like the law of nature, where every action has an equivalent and opposite reaction. It's a law of physics. So you can't stop a reaction from occurring. But you have a free will to respond to the situation. You have a free will to make it as a seed that is going to bear a fruitful output, or it is going to be a bad output. Is it a fair understanding of connecting the two dots?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it's kind of like one way to think of it is previous karma produces this moment of experience, and then your response is what plants the seeds for the future. And that response includes being ignorant of what is going on right now, which is how we kind of are most of the time, I think. But anyway, yes, absolutely. Like there's a fruit from the past, and then you're planting seeds through choice. So thank you. All right, well, wonderful. Wonderful to be with you. And yeah, now if this talk seemed heavy to you, I just invite you to go out and let the cool air touch your face, mm-hmm. or maybe give someone a hug, or just take their hand, or just hold your heart. You know. You know. You're good. I believe it. So I will turn it over to Ardoan. Thank you.